This month marks 5 years since a landmark deal between Turkey and the European Union that halted the movement of refugees and asylum seekers across the continent. Until then, those who made it to Greece by boat could travel to other countries like Germany, who can forget the parade of people, such a tortured parade of people seeking shelter, seeking a new home. The new policy, though, meant thousands of people were instead stranded in Turkey or left to live in refugee camps on the Greek islands. Zoe Holman is a journalist based in Greece. She's written a new book. It's called Where the Water Ends, which reveals what happened to those people who were left in limbo by that agreement between Turkey and the EU. Zoe Holman, welcome to Breakfast.
Hi, Fran. Thanks for having me.
Your book really takes a close look at the at what happened after this EU-Turkey agreement was signed. It was declared a great breakthrough moment. Just take us back to 2016. Tens of thousands of people were streaming into Europe from Syria, Iraq, North Africa. What was behind this deal being struck, and what did this deal do?
Yeah, okay. So the EU-Turkey deal effectively signalled a kind of major shift in the EU's response to this surge in migration that we saw in 2015. So prior to March 2016, anyone who arrived in Europe from Turkey via the Greek islands, and this is where the majority of people landed when coming to Europe, could travel freely, as you said, through open borders into EU countries, and most people sort of sought asylum in northern European states like Germany or Sweden. However, at the beginning of 2016, we see EU states beginning to seal their borders. And then in March 2016, the EU signs this agreement with Turkey, which is essentially aimed at halting the migration into Europe. So the deal centres on a kind of quid pro quo, whereby Turkey is obliged to prevent sea crossings into the EU in return for 6 billion EU in assistance. Mm-hmm. And it was also obliged to accept returned refugees from Greece in exchange for the EU resettling recognised refugees from within Turkey. So in order that the agreement didn't breach international law, the EU then listed Turkey as a so-called safe third country for refugees, meaning they could legally deport people there. So basically, anyone arriving to the Greek islands or mainland since the agreement is obliged to remain at their site of arrival, so until their claim for asylum has been processed, which means either they've been granted protection in Greece or they've been deported to Turkey or elsewhere. And the average processing time for this can be anywhere from a few months to several years. So, for example, some individuals I met recently who'd arrived in Lesbos had their interview scheduled for 2023.
Wow.
So this has led to the situation that we see today in Greece, where we have approximately 150 people stuck in the country.
150,000,
and almost 20,000 of those are detained in the appalling conditions we've seen on the Aegean Islands.
So what it's meant,
kind of effectively become.
What it's meant is a bottleneck, is that there was a deal signed that suggested that people would come across the sea, that land in Turkey. Turkey would process them and send most of them or many of them back to Turkey, and in exchange for Turkey doing that, someone who's being held in Turkey for resettlement would be settled somewhere. But that hasn't happened. Effectively, 150,000 people have got stuck in Greece. Is that right?
Exactly.
And how are they being held in Greece? Because I think most of us have sort of stopped paying attention, really, once that stream of sort of misery marching through Europe was off our television screens. How are they being held there?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, as many people have described, these Aegean islands have kind of become open-air prisons effectively. So even for people who do manage to reach the Greek islands, this is by no means any guarantee of security. Yeah. As your listeners will probably be aware, the material conditions in these overcrowded island camps are just shocking. You know, we have huge rates of everyday violence and sexual abuse, including against minors, who make up around 30% of the people there. And as you can imagine, this kind of insecurity and the interminable waiting has created a mental health kind of crisis. So we see, you know, huge rates of self-harm and trauma, much like what we're seeing, I suppose, in Australia's own detention centres, you know, on Manus and Nauru.
So how many people are in these camps? You focus a lot on a camp on the Greek island of Lesbos. I think it's called Moria. Moria, is that how I say it?
Moria. That's
Moria.
The one, yeah.
Moria camp. It was. It's a major camp. It's a big camp, but it was very overcrowded before a fire swept through it last year. How many people were held there?
Then there was about 19,000 people in this camp, so it was around three times its capacity. And I mean, as it's sort of been described, it was one of the most expensive slums in the world, let's say, you know, with the EU having poured around 1.5 billion into Greece to deal with this migration situation. But I mean, the everyday sanitation there was appalling. As you mentioned, this camp was actually burned down as a corollary, we can say, of the treatment of people there last year. And in its place, they've constructed a new camp on Lesbos. So some people were shifted, and now the current camp still has approximately 8,000 people there. And again, the conditions there are just pretty dire, really. There's zero sanitation. People are living exposed to the sea, extreme weather conditions. There's lead poisoning in the water. I mean, it's just pretty catastrophic.
And are they being processed at all? I know you've paid another visit to Moria recently. Are they being processed at all?
That people are being processed. However, as you can imagine, the pandemic has kind of, you know, brought a halt to a lot of processing systems and slowed things down, as well as making the system a lot less transparent. So a lot is going on that's not necessarily open to public scrutiny. So people are being processed, but the rate is very slow, and we're also seeing much higher rejection rates now. So the rejection rate, I think, is, you know, approximately 30% of people. So we have even people like from Syria and Afghanistan being rejected. So, you know, it's still an extremely protracted and extremely insecure situation, even while people are waiting. And there's by no means any guarantee of security at the end of that process.
There are, of course, many, well, thousands probably for every single person, pretty tragic stories here. And you tell some of them in the book, including this one was really heartbreaking, of a family of seven fleeing Syria. We all know what people were fleeing. They eventually get out of the country. They try to cross from Turkey to Greece 15 times. So this is at the time of ISIS. They're crossing. Tell us about that family, why they were going to such lengths to reach Europe and what happened to them.
Yeah, so the family was a couple called Salwa and Muatez who were from Syria, and they'd been first internally displaced within Syria by the bombardment of their city homes, and then they were again displaced with the violence in Idlib with ISIS. So after finally these, you know, endless attempts at reaching Europe, which, as you can imagine, are extremely precarious and traumatic in themselves, they reached Greece just at the time that this EU-Turkey deal was being implemented. So the borders were gradually closing, and there was a lot of ambiguity around the situation in Greece. And when they reached the border with Macedonia, it was literally the time the border was closing, and their two youngest children, who I think were around 7 and 10 at the time, were actually swept ahead through the border. The border was then sealed, and the family was separated effectively between Macedonia and Greece. And it was only, I think, 18 months later or something, these children were taken to Germany, put in a home for unaccompanied minors, and it was 18 months later that they were reunited. And you can imagine the trauma and just the heartbreak that this inflicts upon families in the longer term. You know, it's not just a short-term experience.
Zoe, can I just ask you finally and briefly why you're telling this story? You're spending a lot of your life living in and around these places.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's several main reasons. On the one hand, with this particular book, you know, so much of what we hear when we hear accounts of refugees is about the trauma and hardship they've suffered in their own home countries, you know, be it Iraq or Syria. But at the same time, you know, the EU frontier is the world's deadliest frontier. Mm. And, you know, I felt it was equally important to focus on the kind of violence that the EU border regime inflicts on people that's equally damaging sometimes. And I guess another part of it was that as an Australian, you know, it's very difficult to approach this situation without seeing the parallels, you know, to Australia's own sort of border system, which in many ways has pioneered the kind of emphasis on closed detention and isolation and deportation that we've seen, you know, implemented here in Europe. Yeah.
All right, Zoe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Fran.
Zoe Holman. Bye. She's written this book, Where the Water Ends, published by Melbourne University Press, Seeking Refuge in Fortress Europe.